Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. It's Sunday, February 18th,
right.
2018. There you have it.
Yeah, 1818. And here we are, back again. We saw a movie last night.
Yeah. It's President Day weekend, by the way.
It is President Day weekend.
Not that Washington's birthday is tomorrow.
No.
But it's sort of in celebration of all those presidents and their birthdays.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have a special presidential segment today.
We are, but later on.
Yeah.
But later on. So we saw Darkest Hour last night, which is the movie about England under the Blitz by Germany, in particular with a focal point on Winston Churchill.
Starring
Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill and a performance you're hearing much about.
Can I just apologize?
What's that?
Gary Oldman is not married to Leslie Mann.
Oh, not married at all?
No, they haven't been married for a long, 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 long time.
Were they married earlier?
They were married. They have a child together.
That's close enough.
But yeah. That's it. No more commentary by me
last week,
the love lives.
Last week we had mentioned
of celebrities.
Leslie Mann always thought she was married to Gary Oldman. In any event, Gary Oldman, married or not, is almost unrecognizable as Winston Churchill. That must have been quite a
no. He's show. Recognizable as Winston Churchill.
Well, yes, but not
but
as Gary Oldman.
Not as Gary Oldman.
Not as Gary Oldman. And so he is. That's a bravura performance. He's playing this huge political figure, this huge historical figure. He completely inhabits the figure. He's totally convincing. He'll win Best Actor at the Oscars and all that. And that becomes the reason to see the movie, at least going in. And quite apart from that, I enjoyed the movie. What did you think?
Yes. We weren't terribly excited about it. And I think...
Going in,
yeah. Even though we've known people who saw it, who enjoyed it, it was recommended to us.
Right.
It just sounded like, how could it be that interesting?
That's old
but
stuff.
But it was very engaging.
It's old stuff, yes.
You were very, you were on the edge of the seat. Will England survive?
Right.
Which is funny, because we knew.
Well, we knew the ending. But, you know, what it did do in a convincing way, and it is almost in a newsreel fashion, and things march along. And they bring you into that point in time. We
did
learn things. I learned things I didn't know before.
Yeah.
All the details about how fragile England was in May 1941, how it could have gone either way, how they were actively considering actually capitulating and negotiating a treaty with Mussolini and Hitler. That's quite vivid, and it's quite alarming. And it all, maybe the movie exaggerates, I don't know, but it all seems to have fallen on the shoulders of Churchill, who seemed to be the only sane man in London at the time. I mean, there's quite a difference between Churchill and everybody else.
But in many ways, not very sane.
No, he had his own peccadillos.
Yes. He was an amazing drinker.
Yeah.
I mean, once you see one of these... fictionalized history movies,
right.
You wonder how much is true.
Right.
So you wonder, could anybody drink that much and still run a country?
Well, it's obvious because so obvious the king says something to him about it.
Right. The king says, how do you do that? How do you drink that much?
And
what is...
he says, practice.
practice.
But the king's not a big talker. So if the king notices it, it's obvious. Two things about this movie. Number one is, it takes us back to the trip we had to Normandy a couple of years ago, and we were there a few weeks within the exact anniversary, 50th anniversary of the invasion of Normandy.
Yeah.
And it was quite compelling, quite a lot of history there, as you can well imagine. And one of the things that we had a chance to experience was there is a film that they show you in the town of Aromanc. And what's interesting about this film is that it's on a high on a hill, and it's a 360-degree film experience. It's a 20-minute film, and you're standing, and they are showing you film, real stock footage.
The screen is 360
degrees. Yeah, surround
you. Surround
you. You have to keep spinning around or looking around, and you're hearing Churchill's voice from the back. You're hearing Hitler's voice from the front. You're seeing Germans marching on the left. You're seeing English marching on the right.
Right. It's archival footage.
Yeah.
Of the invasion,
yeah.
Of speeches by Hitler, speeches by Churchill, was
and real the, action and the invasion of yeah. and the invasion of Normandy
and the invasion
plenty of footage from the invasion of Normandy.
It was absolutely I mean, it was extremely touching.
Well, you had said
because
to
you
me,
saw the faces of the young men
and they're young,
the boys.
They were the boys,
people younger than our own children,
right.
At this point,
right?
About to, and they seemed excited. They didn't know what was coming next.
And they're hitting the beach,
yeah,
and in terrifying circumstances. This reminded us a little of that because it was this newsreel style.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a little more compelling, but that's in Normandy. This is easier to get to. The other thing is that I was thinking was watching the movie is, you know, it's a movie and it does set up in such a way that it's, you know, the world is hanging in the balance and you have, it's all based on the decisions that these men will make, even as you see these bombs coming from the sky and explosions and all kinds of stuff. And you say to yourself, you know, it's somewhat reminiscent even of the Marvel movies, the superhero movies that we see now. It's a similar theme. It's, you know, the world hangs in the balance.
Right.
There's some conflagration. There's some huge battle.
Civilization is facing some complete annihilation.
Right. And then you say to yourself, yeah, except for one thing, this is real.
Yeah.
This is real. But more than that, what I'm reminded of, and I was just mentioning to you before, that's where the Marvel comics come from.
Mm-hmm.
The guys who wrote the Marvel comics in the 50s, we're just out of that wartime experience. So the characters, to give you an example, the easiest one is Magneto is a very large figure in the Marvel Universe involving the X-Men. He's a character, his real name is Max Eisenstadt. He is in two death camps. He's in Treblinka, and then he's in Auschwitz. And his family is killed, and he survives Auschwitz. And then he goes to Israel to work in some relief, and who does he meet in Israel but a fellow named Charles Xavier, and that is, of course, Mr. X, who starts the X-Men. And so that's where the stories come from.
Right.
I'm sorry, it's Professor X. Is that his name?
I don't know.
Yes.
You're the comic book guy.
Yes, that's who it is. But in any event, that's where the X-Men comes from. It comes out of people who were living in a circumstance like the lands invaded by Nazi Germany, and the way they express it in the comic books is they have mutant powers. And so that's the connection, oddly, between those movies and the Marvel movies that we're seeing at the same time.
Except, well, that's interesting.
Except you wonder whether the people watching the Marvel movies know where they came from. They come from this. They come from the darkest hour.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's quite...
I mean, it was kind of amazing sitting there and having people, you know, discuss... Yeah. The Germans are coming. We have nothing to stop them.
Right, nothing.
We cannot stop them.
Right. So it's riveting.
Yeah. Riveting.
So you might want to see that. So in any event, moving on, you found
But charming, too. I loved his secretary.
Yeah.
What was her name?
Well, I forget her name. The actress is Lily James.
Lily James. Miss Layton was her name in the movie.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Of course. And Clemmy. His wife.
This is Kristen Scott Thomas.
They were all terrific and charming, and you know, and there's beautiful clothes and interesting interiors and great food. The breakfast Churchill used to eat.
Yes.
With champagne.
Well, you'd like him to eat a lot if he's going to drink that much. You don't want him.
I was starving by the time we got through that movie.
Right. Well, good, because now your next article is about food.
Yeah, yeah, a lot about food. Numero uno, a new book is out called The Food Explorer. The book is by Daniel Stone, and it's about David Fairchild, who lived from 1869 to 1954. He describes himself as a food spy. He worked for the... Department of Agriculture, traveling around the world, discovering new foods.
You're breathless already. You're really buying into this food spy thing.
Well, I mean, it sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah.
He was a roving botanist.
Yes.
And he shipped home more than 4,000 plant varieties. You need
spy,
to understand right. that in the 19th century, in the early 19th century, Americans are still... eating a fairly limited diet, okay,
right.
based on the limited tastes of England, etc., that they came from. He's going to introduce us to avocados, kale, mangoes, zucchinis, dates, nectarines, pistachios, cashews, and more. And so he, you know, he's a very key guy that none of us have ever heard of, okay? And he has some interesting adventures. First one being one of the first ones in Corsica, where they mistake him for a political spy, not a food spy.
Oh, well, too bad.
He ends up in jail. He gets out of jail, and he's there tracking down the citron, okay, which is important in the development of the modern American orange.
Okay.
Which we're all nuts about.
Tracking down the
citron. Right, okay. Yeah. And so he gets out of jail somehow, but manages to slip out of the country with at least a few citron plants in his back pocket, which will have a great effect. He, at some point, is in Fiji, where cannibalism is the thing. Okay. But lucky for him, in Fiji, they're not interested in, they feel that the white man carries disease. And doesn't taste very good.
It doesn't eat right.
So he is not...
He's safe.
Yeah, he's safe from that. In Chile, he acquires that first stock of avocado seeds. Mm-hmm. He has some failures. He thinks quinoa is going to be a real hit.
But he's right.
He thinks it's fabulous. It takes... Over 100 years, though.
It takes
Nobody
some time.
Has been interested in quinoa until the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, whatever like that. Also, something called the mangosteen doesn't succeed. He thinks that will be a huge...
We ought to give the name of the book again, in case anybody wants to pick it
up.
The Food Explorer by Daniel Stone. Well, speaking of avocados, the journal had another article about avocados, and the question is just, why suddenly are we waking up to avocados? But there it is. What explains our mania for avocados? We've been in a deep sleep about this. And now, boom, everyone needs avocados and everything, and we had the avocado toast this morning.
I mean, avocados are everywhere. I've never seen so many avocados in the grocery store, and there's a good reason for that.
Yes, okay? two good reasons.
Well, two good reasons?
Yes, two good reasons. You're going to talk about the fat point, probably.
No, I'm going to talk about the 83-year-old ban on avocado imports from Mexico.
Oh, that's
which
was,
ended
no,
in
that
the
was
90s.
Mine. I'm the economist.
Ended in the 90s. And,
yeah.
You know,
the California growers kept the Mexican avocados from the U.S. market.
So what do you think is the second?
And because they said it was bad for you because they were had too much fat in them. And suddenly people woke up to saying, well, there's fat and there's fat.
I don't know. It was for years. It was just kind of a weird thing. I mean, my mother would serve it with grapefruit.
Right. They noticed.
Or maybe you would see it as the you would have crab salad in an avocado half.
Well,
it just was not really ringing anybody's chimes.
They're exogenous variables. The idea that number one, that they were keeping them out of the country, and number two, that nutritionists had it all wrong about avocados. So here we are.
But that was fairly recent. They decided
that it was okay.
That they decided it was okay, but it was even, I mean, it was around the 80s that people started saying avocados are fat, they will just make you fat. And it turns out avocados are so loaded with nutrition.
Right.
And they're good for everything. They're actually good for your cholesterol, they think now, as opposed to bad for your cholesterol.
Well, you know, the good news
is good for your skin, they're anti-inflammatory, they have probably more vitamin C than an orange. Speaking of things that have more vitamin C than an orange, because, you know, we're all crazed now with the vitamin C because we're trying to avoid the flu.
Yeah.
And we have in our minds if we have enough vitamin C.
I see your charts up about this. Go ahead.
It's just funny. I mean, really, actually, orange juice has gone down. Mm-hmm. Purchases of orange juice.
Right.
Popularity of orange juice has gone down.
But now they're up.
I mean, we all grew up drinking a little bit of orange juice every morning.
But now they're up because of the flu.
Because of the flu. But the truth is, vitamin C is everywhere.
Right.
You know, chili peppers, red peppers, green peppers have almost three times the amount of vitamin C per cup or whatever.
Kale
is loaded with it. Of course, kale cures everything.
Right.
Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, broccoli, papaya, strawberries, kiwi, it's all over the place. So don't be distressed if you're not an orange juice fan or if your store has run out, because vitamin C is available. squeeze yourself a little bit of kale.
Yeah. So the leading sports writer, or one of the leading sports writers of the late 1940s, was a man named Paul Gallico. But at one point he decided to leave sports writing. And someone said to him, why is he leaving sports writing? And he answered in one word, February. February. There's no sports.
Am I supposed to be laughing? Is February. That hilarious? Is that a joke?
No, it's true.
Okay, it's just true.
It's true.
There's no sports in February.
Right, which is why...
I'm still not following it.
Here's the point. Okay. The point is, there's no sports in February, particularly then, and it is that gap that Sports Illustrated had to fill in order to survive in its early days. And what they fill it with?
The swimsuit issue.
The swimsuit issue.
Well, that's pretty hilarious.
Well, it's true.
We've talked about this before. I think we talked about this last February or March.
Really?
March when it comes out. Yeah, because we joked about how, you know, there's always the irate letter from the head of some Catholic school saying, I can't believe us this pornography.
Well,
we thought we were getting a sports magazine.
I have actually found what's considered the top letter in that connection, but I'll get to that in just 1 minute. Just to give people their due, Andre Laguerre was the name of the fellow who ran Sports Illustrated in the early days.
So he's like French?
He's not like French. He is French.
He is French.
More than that,
the French would come up with this.
More than that, wait a second. He also escaped the German army at Dunkirk, just to make a connection with the movie we saw last night.
Okay.
So everything comes full circle. And he comes in, he's the editor of the magazine. It begins in 1954. It starts as sort of half sports, half travelogue, half what kind of, you know, fashion should you wear when you're out camping, when you're out in field and stream type mode, because there was no real, they couldn't commit themselves entirely to a sports magazine. They didn't think it really had it. And it was doing fairly well, but it ran into ups and downs, including with respect to February. And in 1964, he came up with the idea of let's have, you know, pictures of women in bathing suits.
You realize that pitchers and catchers is in February. You couldn't talk about spring training?
Andre Laguerre.
That wasn't enough?
Andre Laguerre wasn't on to that because he was a Frenchman. And look, you obviously know where it goes from there. It picks up and it becomes very popular, and it's now responsible for 10% of their revenues. And it's, you know, there are all kinds of debates about how racy it is, whether it's too racy or not racy enough, and how it compares with the rest of the culture and how it's become more accepted now or not. And as you mentioned a moment ago, the letters have always been a big thing. And the letters have gone up and down. There used to be a few hundred letters every year in the 70s or so, cancel my subscription.
Right.
I'm shocked and dismayed. You know, the nuns of so-and-so agree
right.
with me,
yeah.
we have to cancel. And that would go down, but they didn't know whether it meant that the outrage had gone down or whether everyone had already canceled their subscription.
And so what's the answer? Is the outrage back?
The outrage is not back. They get very few letters now.
Oh,
and the reason that they think they get very few letters is because everybody knows it's impossible not to know what's coming in terms
right.
of Sports Illustrated. But they did put out a coffee table book some years ago, and they published what they say is the top letter that they've
coffee
ever
table?
Received. Yes.
This is where you want to read this?
It's coffee
by
table
the coffee
book.
Table?
But it was about the letters.
Thinking most guys are not reading this by the coffee table.
Yeah. And what they say is, here's the best letter they ever got. Dear sirs, we are students at St. Anselm's College, which I will tell you is in Manchester, New Hampshire. Our patron, St. Anselm, was most notable for originating the ontological argument for the existence of God. After reading your annual bathing suit issue, we believe.
Hardy har har har. Okay, fabulous.
That is it. That is a, and they display that at St. Anselm, and they actually tracked down the guys who wrote that just a year ago. And they're celebrated for bringing some positive publicity to St. Anselm because they found the issue a religious experience. So, in any event, there it is. And we'll see if it maintains its popularity. As you know, they're trying to become more relevant, whether that works or not. Well,
relevant? relevant?
You know, it's a controversy.
Yes, they are trying to be more
relevant. They are trying to be more relevant. Yeah,
because it's a touchy situation.
It is.
With
yeah,
the Me Too.
It doesn't seem to fit right. with the cultural moment we're in. But
right, but it never has fit in with any cultural
moment.
We'll
leave that to greater minds than our own, or at least greater minds than my own, as to whether they're navigating those troubled waters.
But other than that, I mean, we do have sports.
Yes.
In this February.
We do.
Did you have more you want to say about swimsuit?
No, I'm done about it.
We have the Olympics and the Winter Olympics.
Yes.
And we've been, you know, we continue to, you know, occasionally watch it.
Yes.
There's only so much you can watch.
Yes.
I personally found, I find the skiing kind of exhilarating, mm-hmm. even though I can't really ski. I've tried to ski, really mm-hmm. can't.
Yeah.
Skeleton
yeah.
is horrifying.
Yeah. Well,
I'm not even sure why it's there.
Yeah.
Skeleton is when the guy lies down.
And is face first.
Face first. Yeah. He has this weird helmet that covers his entire head. Not that it would save you if you really crashed into something.
No, it wouldn't.
No. So who knows why?
They keep the remains of your head in the
but
helmet.
But they have both men and women divisions, right?
They do.
Events, yeah. And it just seems insane.
Well, here's the origins of the skeleton.
Do you know when it originated?
Yeah, they brought it into the St. Luke's, Salt Lake City Olympics. I guess that was 92 or something like that. I can't remember.
Really?
Because
I didn't notice it till the last couple of years.
It's been around for some time, generally as a sport.
Whose idea was it?
It comes from the flexible flyer.
Yes, it sort of does look
like. Okay, so the flexible flyer, for those who don't know, because it's an old-time sled, it's a sled that my parents gave us because they thought, God knows what they were thinking. But when you take a flexible flyer sled out, it's...
Daniel, God knows what was thinking. Everybody had a flexible flyer.
You're right. It's a wooden sled.
Had the wooden slats.
On a metal underpinnings. And the way you... Metal runners. And you would lie down on your stomach. That's the only way to really do
it. And you could steer.
And you could steer with the wooden slat in front.
And that would move the runners, you know, to the left or to the right.
No one can see what you're doing here, does it? But the key point is that it was face first.
Right.
You're lying on your stomach and it's face first. And that was the way my parents thought we should be going down hills, face first. God knows why.
I don't think they thought a lot about it. All kids did it that way.
That's right.
Unless you were some fancy place that had bobsled.
No.
But you can't really bobsled on the streets of, you know, suburban Long Island.
Well, we were going hell for leather down that little hill on 24 Glen Road. And you've seen that yourself. It's a hill which extends for at least, I don't know, 6 or 7 yards, maybe 12. And for us, that was pretty terrifying as a 5-year-old.
Okay, it's still terrifying to me. We watched a little bit of it, tried to get into it.
Well, what they've done... But in any event, I don't think Long Island would be so terrifying. But my point is, what they did was they took the underpinnings and they eventually came to call the underpinnings of the flexible flyer sled the skeleton of the sled because it was all metal. And that's how you got the name skeleton.
So you're just on the skeleton.
Yeah, and you're
fabulous.
On the skeleton.
Fabulous.
And from there, they made it more and more sophisticated. It was first called the American because only the Americans would do this. And it was, and they wouldn't even allow it in the Olympics because it was too dangerous.
Okay.
But then they said, what the heck?
Yeah, it shouldn't be in the Olympics.
Yeah.
So some other notable things about the Olympics. The men's curling, the pants.
Yeah.
The pants are crazy.
Mm.
Absolutely correct. They look like that somebody, you know, went into a Hawaiian shirt factory and started making pants.
You need something to hold your interest if you're going to watch curling, okay? And if it's got to be wild pants.
Are you kidding me? People are loving the women's curling with the South Korean team.
You know,
they're going
that?
Crazy.
South Koreans are
the
going
dark
crazy.
Horse. They're out of nowhere. These girls, all but the last name Kim.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's not
all
unusual.
From some town that heretofore was famous for garlic.
Right.
Okay. So it's really struck a chord.
With them. With the South Korean. Look, there are clearly people cheering about things in the Olympics. And as a viewer here sitting in my own home, I can just say, okay, I guess someone's interested in that. Not me. But that's cool.
And the other weird thing about curling now,
yeah.
Here's an article I didn't read. Can we talk about articles we didn't read?
Sure.
Or can we only talk about articles
we
read?
No, go ahead.
Okay. There was an article about that curlers, I guess they're curlers, the people who curl, are in better shape than they used to be.
Well, okay.
So I'm not sure exactly why you need to be in good shape.
You know why? Because they
curl.
They probably took up another sport.
Because all they're doing is really sweeping like crazy
and
shouting at that poor rock. Or whatever they're shouting.
They're not in good shape because they're curling. I'm not too excited about the skiing. I'm not too excited about the curling.
Do you think anybody's going to be famous from this? Any
from
household
curling?
Names?
From the entire Olympics?
From the Olympics. Anybody
no.
going to remember?
Well, not in the U.S. I mean, you have the people who are famous going in are the only chance of people being famous going out. You know, Lindsey Vonn and the like. Mikhail Shiffrin. But Listen, some people are enthused about those sports, and that's all fine. I can accept that. I'm not particularly enthused about them. I think most of the United States is not enthused about them, which is why they don't captivate any kind of audience except once every 4 years, and even then, spotty. But
I enjoy it. But the one thing I think is odd is when they interview the athletes too much.
Well, that's true of every sport. That's true of every sport.
I think it's asking a lot. These young, pretty much they're young kids.
Yeah.
And they have devoted every waking moment
right.
to a particular physical activity.
Right.
And now they ask them for their pearls of wisdom.
Right.
You know, because they're not just asking about the race or whatever. They seem to be asking about life and preparation
and the
future. And, you know, that's a lot to ask.
Well, it's the same thing like when you interview a college football player or a college basketball player.
Yeah. We want all these poor kids to be, you know, superheroes.
Now, listen, I'm holding out for the ice skating, although I don't think I'm going to get that much out of it. It was funny. We were watching ice skating the other night, and there were had a Latin evening, a short program, and they started playing Rolling Stones.
I know that upset you.
And a sympathy
for
the devil.
Because you're Mr. Music, and you don't...
And I said, listen, that's fine. I don't mind listening to that, but it's not Latin. And then they played Hotel California, and I said, well, I do mind listening to that, but in any event, it's not Latin. And they actually had, there was an article in Sports Illustrated where they noted that this is what the Canadian team did, but they thought it was successful. They thought they managed to work the Latin rhythms into the Stones song and the Eagles song. And they also saluted them for getting for creating a dad rock portion of the evening. So I guess that was specifically for me. And I'm glad I caught it.
So do you think they just did that for sensationalism? Or
God only knows. Yeah, the songs people know.
Okay.
But you wanted to talk about, you had an educational program story. About
I don't know if it's about education in many senses. It's a memoir reviewed in the Wall Street Journal called Educated, a Memoir by Tara Westover.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's the story of her life. And I don't want to go too deeply in it, but she had a bizarre life. She grew up on a mountain in Idaho with, I think, one of seven children. Her father was kind of a nut, a survivalist. They did not go to school, okay? And her mother had suffered a brain injury.
Right.
And kind of alternated between being a kind of a threat herself and not much help at all. She ends up somehow at age 17 deciding she would like to get an education. She wants to go to college.
Right.
She teaches herself enough math and grammar to pass standardized testing and get into BYU. Mm-hmm. She goes to BYU. She gets a scholarship to Cambridge. She ends up getting a PhD in political thought, intellectual history. Okay? So that is bizarre. Three of the seven kids end up getting PhDs. The other never leave the mountain, never go to school, graduate high school.
That's weird.
And so what's interesting about this review by Susan Wise Bauer is the way she sums it up. And a lot of the story apparently isn't that fascinating. It's just mind-boggling that you could get a PhD out of that background. And she really knows nothing. She doesn't know how to study. She doesn't know how education works at all. Somehow she does it. But the way this reviewer sums it up is, without ever meaning to, educated suggests something startling. Our children's intellectual achievement may have almost nothing to do with the opportunities we provide them, and everything to do with some inborn drive that we can neither influence nor create.
Well, that's a relief.
it can be kind of a cop-out. But I think it's interesting that's Educated, a memoir by Tara Westover.
Well, it's some story. Okay, and you had something about Garfield. A Garfield memorial?
When do I get to talk about Nigel?
Later? Yes.
Okay. You're going to tell me?
It's in the obituary section. There, it's a death.
Well, James Garfield.
Yeah.
his monument, his tomb, actually. There's a little discussion of that in the Wall Street Journal, and it's kind of an exotic, fabulous-looking tomb, which is just unusual because most of our president's tombs are unnoticeable. Okay, with the exception of...
They're not remarkable.
Yeah, not remarkable. Grant's tomb.
Grant, I was just going to say Grant's
tomb. There is Grant's tomb.
There's something for Lincoln, I think. A vague recollection. Yeah.
But it's in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's unremarkable right there.
And it was actually at the Lakeview Cemetery. And it was designed by George Keller, who... has done some other stuff. Soldier and Sailors Monument in Hartford. Mm-hmm. Maybe you've seen that. I don't know.
No.
He actually went to Europe. He won a competition for the commission in the early 1880s, and he actually travels around a little bit in Europe to get some ideas. Because they want this to be over the top. We hardly remember Garfield in general.
Right.
I guess he was only president for a few minutes before he was assassinated.
Right.
It's really quite beautiful, has an extraordinary dome, mm-hmm. has glass, Murano glass, stained glass designs in it, etc., and is really... And the way it's described in this article actually calls it more of a monument to the Gilded Age, mm-hmm. and kind of the lifetime, the sort of historical context of the time, more so than even commemorating Garfield. So that seems like an interesting monument to see sometime if you're in Cleveland, which seems like a nice city.
Yeah, sure. I've been there. We're talking about the Met. You did something on the Met too, or not?
Oh, well, the Michelangelo show, Cole, closed.
Right.
And the New York Times noted that it's up there in the top 10 for exhibitions for the number of visitors.
Well, I was quizzing you about this, and you came through, so I couldn't really flummox you. The top two are, as you told me as soon as I asked?
Well, the top two are Mona Lisa and King Tut.
There you go.
Now, I went to King Tut. I don't know if I went to Mona Lisa or not.
Yeah, I saw the Mona Lisa.
Mona Lisa doesn't rock my world.
None of this rocks my world, but
There are many people who say the only reason that Mona Lisa is really famous is because it was stolen.
Really?
Yeah, in 1911, got a lot of publicity. It was all that celebrity of being stolen that really put it on everybody's bucket list.
For all it's worth.
And if you go to the Louvre, I've said this before. People run in, they take a selfie, and
it's a small painting.
Run
that's the real disappointment.
Nobody's too interested.
But anyway, you knew
and
the top.
The other big, some of the other big ones included the Alexander McQueen show.
Right.
He was a famous designer who committed suicide.
That
was an extraordinary show. That was a fun show.
Yeah. That's costume design or something like that?
No. It's a regular designer of clothing for women.
Clothing designer.
Not costumes.
I was close, though.
No, that's not even close. It's an entirely different world.
All right. Okay.
But...
All right. So we have... there are a few obituaries that were kind of interesting this week. One is Jan Maxwell, who was a great actress on Broadway. And she was in a number of big productions, and we saw a couple of them. But she was in The Royal Family, Lend Me a Tenor, Dancing at Lugnaza. She was in a production of Follies. She was in a production of Entertaining Mr. Sloan that we saw. She was in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which we didn't see. But mostly, she was just regarded as really a consummate actress, and the Times wrote two articles about her, and in one of them, the comparisons they drew were to the very top people on Broadway, and they didn't really restrict themselves to actresses. The names that came to their mind were Kevin Kline, Frank Langella, Audra McDonald, Christine Ebersole, Donna Murphy, really that... Those
and yet she's not a household
and Meryl Streep.
World
and
name.
That's exactly the point. I just gave you all the names that are in this article that they view as the right comparison for her, and they are superstars.
Yeah.
Superstars. And they're saying she's right in there with that group. And I can tell you, my sense was for people really into Broadway, a lot of people feel that way, felt that way. And in fact, she was nominated for a Tony 5 times, and she's the only person other than Audra McDonald to be nominated in any in the 5 possible categories you can be nominated in. So, you know, musical, non-musical, supporting, whatever. And she died at a young age, 61, I believe. And so that was a serious loss. She was really a great actress. Vic Damone also passed away. Vic Damone, as the Time describes Vic Damone, someone who was 10 years younger than Sinatra, but was considered right in there with Frank Sinatra, Perry Como, Tony Bennett, as the top singers in the 50s. And somehow he fell just a little bit short of that, although he was quite well known and did very well in Vegas.
Yeah, when we were growing up, he was, you know, in the back of your mind, you knew of him as Mr. Super Smooth.
Yes, right. And he had a gentler voice than Sinatra, and perhaps it didn't carry quite as well. It didn't have the same impact or energy as Tony Bennett, but it was highly successful. But what was very odd reading about his life was it was a lot of crazy stuff. And he was married 5 times. 2 of his former wives committed suicide. He had a lot of 1 or 2 outstandingly crazy incidents with the mob. One of them in particular, when he was dangled outside a New York hotel window after breaking off an engagement with some mobster's daughter. There's a scene like that in The Godfather, in the book. I don't know if that showed up in the movie. He was offered a part of the movie. He wouldn't do it because he thought it was anti-Italian-American. But it was interesting to me that the name of his biography was... I think it was the easiest thing was the singing. And that was true. I mean, he sang...
Well, I don't know if it was in this obituary. I read something about the way he got himself discovered by Frank Sinatra.
Oh, no.
He was working in a restaurant or he was working somewhere and managed to get in a elevator with Sinatra, and he started singing. Impromptu audition.
You're close. He was at something for Frank Sinatra, but the elevator had Perry Como in it.
Oh, Perry Como?
And it was Perry Como who discovered him, and he named his first son Perry, because Perry really helped his career. And I should correct, the name of the book was Singing Was the Easy Part, and you get the feeling that for Vic Damone, singing was the easy part. So I did want to give you a second talk about Nigel, as long as we're talking about figures.
Well, I see that. That's my obituary, the death of Nigel the Gannet.
Yes, Nigel the Gannet.
The loneliest bird in the world, I guess. In New Zealand, there's an island, I guess, called Mana. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it.
Right.
But apparently, at some point, there was an effort to attract gannets, which is a type of seabird, to the island. Mm-hmm. And this was in the 1970s, about 80 cement birds were created and painted and set around the island to try to attract these birds to the island.
Right.
Okay.
And they were successful.
They were not successful.
I thought they... All right.
No, they were not successful. Yeah. And so the birds just, you know, get covered over with weeds.
Right.
And then in the 2000s, around, I guess, 2012, actually, they resurrect these cement gannets. They fix them up. They put them on another part of the island, and they also introduce bird calls, gannet calls, to attract. The only one they attract is Nigel.
Well, they named Nigel, but yes.
Okay, they attract this
one
bird.
One gannet, yeah.
You know, and they were hoping that, you know, he would, by him, he being there, would attract another gannet, and they would mate and attract, you know, create and attract more. Unfortunately, he's alone. He's a loner, and he falls in love with one of the cement gannets already there on the island. He stays there. He builds a nest next to her. Mm-hmm. He attempts to mate with her. He will not leave her. Even though some other live gannets come along. And he was recently found having passed away with having never made it or reproduced. And so it's very sad. And I think they're going to do an autopsy. But there you have it, the loneliest bird on earth. And people were quite intrigued by the whole idea and the story. because, I mean, you know, we've all been through our moments of unrequited love, and, you know, you feel for Nigel.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of bad. He's kind of barking up the wrong tree, so to speak, if I can mix the metaphor there. But there is a
That's
photo.
Pretty mixed.
Look, I looked at the photo in the Times, and you cannot tell the real Gannett from the not real Gannett. So I don't blame Nigel in the least. I mean, that.
Did you look at the videos, too? Because there are videos.
The videos, I think, would give it away. But the photograph, it's impossible to tell what's the real Gannett and not the real Gannett.
All right. Well, perhaps.
All right. So, and we will close with one more obituary, and that's of Wesla Whitfield, who was a cabaret singer. And, you know, she's a fine singer. You know, there's a quote in her obituary, which I think really kind of resonates. She's, you know, she sang standards. And
mostly in the New York area, or?
No, all over the place. Actually, her principal base, home base was San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
Spent more time than any place else. And what she had an interesting quote. She said, "We think of the songs we perform as classic." And she did start out as an opera singer. But she said, in the same way that Schubert songs are classic, these are classic. They're not nostalgic, even though they're old, but they speak to the human condition today, which I think is true of these kind of cabaret songs. So I, you know, and I think you too have heard Wesla Whitfield over the years. And what there's one thing I didn't know about Wesla Whitfield until I read the obituary, and that is she was in a wheelchair. In the 1970s, when she was a young singer, she was accosted by these two young men, and she was shot, and she was paralyzed from the waist down, and she's been in a wheelchair ever since then. And it's not something she talked about a lot, and you wouldn't know if you didn't see her in person. And even in NPR, she was asked about it on a Weekend Edition in the 90s. She said, "I don't talk about it. It has nothing to do with my life and certainly, definitely nothing to do with my music." And so what happened, her story is this. She was performing in the San Francisco area, and she was spotted by a British pianist named Mike Greensill. And they started performing together, and they fell in love and got married. Mike Greensill was the house pianist in a San Francisco public radio show called West Coast Live. And she would often come on and sing. Greensill would carry her on the stage and get her situated, and she'd sing. And her career took off, but I should say their career, because they performed together. The Times wrote a review in 1993 when they were appearing in the Oak Room in New York. And Stephen Holden said, "Although Mrs. Whitfield and Mr. Greensill are not the only married cabaret performers who work together, no cabaret couple in recent memory has expressed their devotion through such intense but subtle musical communication."
So a nice little post-Valentine love story.
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny. There's even some story, I won't go into it here, about being on a show. They tried to draw her out. Kathy Lee Gifford tried to draw her out in terms of talking about being a wheelchair. So that's not going to talk about. In any event, what she said about singing while sitting, she said, "I've always preferred sitting. It brings everything to a stop. And then we just focus on the music."
All right.
So we will we'll leave you with a couple minutes from Wesla Whitfield, a number, I didn't know what time it was. And until next week.
This is Tamsin Granger and
Dan Apuha.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. See you then.
Thank you.
Once I was young, yesterday perhaps, dance with Jim and Paul, kiss some other chaps. Once I was young, but never was naive. Thought I had a trick or two up my imaginary sleeve. And now I know I was naive. I didn't know what time it was. Then I met you. What a lovely time it was, how sublime it was too. I didn't know what day it was you held. must say it was grand to be alive, to be young, to be mad, to be yours alone. Grand to see your face, feel your touch, hear your voice say, I'm all your own. I didn't know love, and here it was, shining up.